Now consider case number 21-8010, United States versus Shakespeare. Mr. Jackson, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel, Robert Jackson appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Laquan Shakespeare. The mandatory revocation and mandatory minimum sentence provisions at 18 U.S.C. Section 3583K are unconstitutional. This court and the Supreme Court have both said as much. And Mr. Shakespeare presents two claims in relation to his being sentenced to a mandatory minimum term of 60 months imprisonment. First, Mr. Shakespeare presents the same violation as was at issue in Hayman. He was revoked for committing a specified sex offense, which in turn triggered a mandatory term of re-imprisonment for at least 5 years. Because Shakespeare's punishment was premised upon the new offense, his revocation more closely resembled the prosecution for a new offense than a regular revocation proceeding. Yet he wasn't afforded all of the rights attendant a new criminal prosecution. Second, and alternatively, Mr. Shakespeare incurred a double jeopardy violation because he was prosecuted and sentenced to 293 months on the new offense, and then sentenced to 60 months re-imprisonment in relation to the revocation. Normally, this wouldn't be an issue, but 3583K serves to punish for the new offense as opposed to regular revocations, which are tied to the original offense of conviction, pursuant to the well-known framework at 3583E3, where the revocation term is tied to the severity of the initial offense. Given these dual circumstances in play, Mr. Shakespeare's case must be remanded to the district court for resentencing pursuant to subsection E3, where he will face a maximum term of imprisonment of 2 years.
With you acknowledge that the standard review is plain error.
Yes, Your Honor.
So this is to be clearly erroneous. It's got to be a clear violation of double jeopardy, for example.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe it is. The standard of review is plain error because there wasn't a single whisper of Hayman below in the district court. The probation office didn't mention Hayman in its violation report. Defense counsel didn't mention Hayman.
Well, the important thing is defense counsel didn't mention it.
That's the most important thing. That triggers the plain error. Yes, Judge.
Yeah. So the fact that others missed it is not, I don't think, relevant here. So what, let's start with double jeopardy. What authority do you have that this type of revocation proceeding, even though it is required to be proved to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, this type of revocation proceeding creates a double jeopardy problem when there's both revocation of probation and conviction of the new offense? Because ordinarily that's not a problem. When you revoke probation, you can revoke probation, send someone to jail. If this weren't mandatory, for example, the judge could have imposed the exact same sentence and there wouldn't be any double jeopardy problem. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. In the Johnson context of revocation, the revocation penalty is considered part of the penalty for the initial offense.
Well, this is still a revocation penalty. The difference is that unlike most revocations, which are determined by a judge on a preponderance of the evidence standard, here to revoke under this provision, you've got to be guilty beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. So what's the? But it's still a revocation. It's still part of the original sentence. Maybe there's a good argument. Well, there is a decent argument for double jeopardy, but we're confronted with plain error review here. And I don't think there's a single case out there that addresses this issue. How can we say the district judge plainly erred?
Judge, you posed two questions there, and I want to make sure I answer both of them.
Okay.
Okay, I'll take the plain error question first. With respect to double jeopardy, the errors claim. And I talked about the Finnessy case in my brief, and there this court said that for an error to be plain, either the Tenth Circuit or the Supreme Court must have addressed the situation. This court did address the double jeopardy angle in Haymond 1, in the Haymond case it decided, and it talked about, hey, watch out, while it's not at issue here in Haymond, if the defendant was also prosecuted for the new offense, we would have a double jeopardy issue on our hands.
We'd have an issue. First of all, that's clearly dictum, but did they say we'd have an issue or would clearly violate the prohibition on double jeopardy?
The court said it would violate the prohibition because the defendant would be, quote, charged and punished twice for the same offense. And that Haymond 1 decision relied on the earlier 2017 case of United States versus Collins, Judge Holmes' decision. And in Collins, the court said the same thing. We cannot premise the revocation penalty, the length of the revocation penalty, on the new offense conduct because that would be a violation of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, including double jeopardy. As for your second question, Your Honor, is this proceeding still a revocation? Well, Justice Breyer made that distinction. And I think in name only is this 3583K proceeding a revocation. And Justice Breyer made that distinction based upon his three criteria, that a 3583K revocation most closely resembles a new prosecution. And that's because subsection K is only triggered upon commission of certain enumerated federal sex offenses. Second, subsection K completely removes a district court's discretion to determine if imprisonment is warranted and for how long that imprisonment should be warranted.
And did the prevailing plurality in Haymond, in the Supreme Court, did it adopt the same view as Justice Breyer on that point?
Justice Gorsuch took a different approach. He adopted the Ring Revolution and the Apprendi line of cases in his analysis in the plurality opinion.
But did the Gorsuch opinion address double jeopardy?
Your Honor, I believe there was maybe one sentence in there that teased at it, but I'm not going to say, and I'm not going to tell you that it directly addressed double jeopardy.
Because Justice Breyer's opinion may be the controlling authority because it's the narrow on the requirement of a trial by a jury with the requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But that doesn't mean everything Justice Breyer said in his concurrence is Supreme Court authority. If he's the only one who mentioned the double jeopardy issue and said, suggested there's a double jeopardy violation, that would not be controlling authority from our point of view. It's just what one justice. I mean, we have to respect his opinion, of course, but if he's alone in that regard, I don't think that would be authority. We're probably on stronger ground with the Tenth Circuit opinion, although that was dictum, obviously.
Your Honor, I don't read Justice Breyer's narrow concurrence to discuss double jeopardy, and I'm sorry if I gave the court that.
Oh, okay, okay, opinion. Okay. I thought when you were giving authority for the double jeopardy argument, you said, well, first it was discussed in Haymond 1, and then I thought you were turning to the Supreme Court and saying they also said it. I apologize if I misunderstood.
Well, I do want to make sure I answered both of your earlier questions. I think you inquired if this was still a revocation proceeding.
Okay.
That's what I was getting to.
Justice
Breyer said, well, in name only, it is. It really looks a lot more like a new prosecution to me. Okay. I think that's what Justice Breyer was getting at.
Let's turn to the other issue. We took more time on that than I expected. Why don't you address that?
Definitely. Mr. Shakespeare has two very viable issues here. And with respect to the first issue, that's the same issue raised in the Haman case. Can we constitutionally have a revocation that's not tied to the initial offense of conviction, and instead it's tied to the new offense conduct? Constitutionally, counsel, I just don't...
Counsel, isn't the difference between Haman and this case, that in this case, Mr. Shakespeare admitted everything, so there was no need for a jury trial, as suggested by the Supreme Court in the Haman case?
That's a distinction that I don't think makes a difference, Your Honor, and I don't think it makes a difference for a number of reasons. The first of those reasons being, Haman went and pled guilty in November of 2020 to the new offense. And then it wasn't until December that the government sprung the violation petition on him. So there was a lack of knowing waiver, knowing stipulation of the to the revocation conduct. Also,
I guess I'm not following that. In Haman, the court said he's entitled to a jury trial on the issues in the revocation action, and he didn't get it, and he is entitled to have it approved beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, Mr. Shakespeare pled guilty to the underlying as well as the overlying cases. And so there was no issue there that he was deprived of a jury trial, unless you're raising an ineffective assistance claim, which I didn't see in the brief.
No, Your Honor, there's no ineffective assistance claim. I think I need a 2255 to do that. But with respect to the Supreme Court saying that a jury trial was necessary, that wasn't the holding. The narrow concurrence was that 3583K was unconstitutional and the matter needed to be remanded to this court to determine what the appropriate remedy should be. And perhaps that was a jury trial in Mr. Haman's case. Here, Mr. Shakespeare, and it's very apparent from the record, was never informed that he had any sort of right to a jury proceeding with respect to the revocation. When the judge advised him, in conjunction with his stipulating to the violation conduct, the judge said, well, hey, if you don't stipulate, you'll just be entitled to a bench trial and a finding by the preponderance of the evidence. So that waiver wasn't knowingly involuntary on Mr. Shakespeare's part. Also, despite the plea,
an ineffective assistance issue.
Your Honor, I patently believe it was ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't know why counsel was unaware of this case. It's right there, plain as day, in the West statutes. Right after the statute, it says deemed unconstitutional by United States versus Haman. But we're not in the 2255 posture. I think my hands are tied in terms of raising that ineffective assistance claim. And I think we have a pure legal claim given Haman, and we have a pure instance of plain error. With respect to Mr. Shakespeare, he was harmed exactly the same as Mr. Haman was harmed, and his circumstances were the same. Once the violation was found by the district court, whether it was in Haman's case or Shakespeare's case, all of a sudden 3583K springs up and removes any discretion from that district court. And now Mr. Shakespeare, who committed a 0-15 offense in the first instance, is subject to a 5-to-life sentence just on the revo.
Are you saying that a mandatory minimum set by Congress is unconstitutional?
In the revocation context, I believe absolutely, Your Honor, it is.
All right, I just wanted to understand your position.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm out of time.
Well, you're saying it's unconstitutional, but it's not unconstitutional if there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt before a jury, correct?
That could be a potential remedy. However, that remedy won't work here because then we run into that double jeopardy issue because Mr. Shakespeare was also convicted of the new offense. You can't have both, is my position. You can't have a new prosecution subject to the protections of the Constitution and then a revocation prosecution for the exact same conduct with a second jury.
Let's divide off the double jeopardy issue. Aside from the double jeopardy issue, say Mr. Shakespeare was not prosecuted for the new offense.
Okay.
Then his supervised release could be revoked under the statute if there was a proceeding in which a jury found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that not correct?
I'm very hesitant to say yes. We would have to have a full-blown criminal trial because it really concerns me because the federal rules of evidence say that the rules of evidence don't apply to revocation proceedings. This needs to be a very, very formal and trial-like proceeding if that's the road we're going to go down.
Well, when Booker was before the Supreme Court, four justices would have adopted that view for sentencing under mandatory guidelines. Am I correct about that? Justice Stevens' opinion expressed that view, that the Booker problem with the Sixth Amendment could be solved by just requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury. And that opinion thought that was consistent with the statute, with the sentencing guideline statute. So I assume that would also be at least a probability or possibility. When we're talking about clear error or plain error here, when four justices think that that's an adequate way to proceed, it's hard to say that it would be plain error to go with that remedy. Am I missing something there?
No, I certainly recall Booker, and I believe we have a Booker problem here with the issue of 3583K removing a judge's discretion. But with respect to the jury finding, we better have all the protections of the Sixth Amendment and the federal rules of evidence if we're going to go down that route.
Well, this is a very constitutional, but I'd be surprised if the judge wouldn't apply the usual rules in such a proceeding. But okay. Are there any further questions from the panel? Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Mr. Valentini.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Francesco Valentini and I represent the United States. Mr. Shakespeare has shown no violation of his jury trial or double jeopardy rights, and certainly not under the plain error review that applies in this case. Neither the Supreme Court nor this court has ever found a jury right violation in a case like this one, in which a defendant admitted the relevant fact. The Supreme Court has made clear time and again that the right to a jury trial does not extend to facts, quote, admitted by the defendant. He says so in Apprendi, in Blakely versus Washington, later at the same point in United States versus Booker, and then in Cunningham versus California, among other cases. This court too has made the point time and again, including United States versus Porter, and in some bonk decision in 2005, United States versus Gonzalez-Huerta. Gonzalez-Huerta is a particularly enlightening case in this respect because it was decided shortly after Booker. And in that case, this court explained that where a sentencing that occurred before Booker, and based on the mandatory guidelines, was based solely upon facts admitted by the defendant in calculating the maximum sentence, any error under Booker was, quote, non-constitutional, meaning the defendant's Sixth Amendment right, the right to a jury trial, was not violated under those circumstances. And nothing in Haman upsets this longstanding principle that admitted facts, that where a defendant admits facts, it does not have a right to a jury trial. And in fact, Haman confirmed the same point in the specific context of Section 3583K. Justice Gorsuch's plurality opinion made clear that the jury trial right does not extend to facts admitted by the defendant. And Justice Breyer's concurrence, too, identified the fact that, and I emphasize, a judge found that the defendant committed some of the enumerated offenses in 3583K, as opposed to those facts being admitted or found by the jury, as the one of the three decisive considerations that weighed in favor of extending the jury right to a jury trial. Here, Shakespeare, and there's no confusion about that, and there's no dispute about that, admitted all the relevant facts, not once but twice, and both times in open court. He admitted the relevant facts, the fact that he had raped a minor when he pleaded guilty to the charges in case number 20-124, and he admitted them again at the revocation hearing under 3583K, after defense counsel actually invited the court to take judicial notice of the guilty plea to satisfy the factual statement, the factual predicate for that revocation. And at a minimum, as Judge Hartz pointed out before, any concern under the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial would not rise to the level of plain error, which is the standard which I understand my friend on the other side acknowledges and acknowledging the brief applies in this case. For that reason, we don't think there is any plausible argument that Mr. Shakespeare's Sixth Amendment rights were violated in this case. The next point I wanted to touch on very briefly is this notion, this possibility that Section 3583K might be facially unenforceable. I understand my friend on the other side to have conceded and abandoned that point in the reply, where it makes clear in responding to that, because we did brief the issue of facial unenforceability as a potential remedy under Haman. And I understand my friend on the other side to have abandoned that issue in the reply, when on page 7 and 8, they say it is Mr. Shakespeare's position that Section 3583K is unenforceable in his circumstance because he was separately prosecuted and sentenced for the new offense. That is, that goes to the double jeopardy claim, but does not advance sort of a remedial argument, a la Booker, if you will. And my colleague on the other side's presentation today reiterated the point. There is no claim in this case that Section 3583K is facially unconstitutional. And even if there were a claim of that sort, as Judge Hartz also mentioned just a few minutes ago, that would not rise to the level of plain error review under Rule 52 and the Supreme Court's precedent in Olano and like cases. The last issue that I wanted to touch on very briefly is double jeopardy. To prevail on a cumulative punishment double jeopardy violation claim, Mr. Shakespeare will have to show two things, both under the heightened plain error standard. First, that is, the 3583 revocation sentence was jeopardy for a new offense within the meaning of the double jeopardy clause. And second, the Congress did not intend the two penalties to be used cumulatively, to be available cumulatively. Johnson versus the United States, decided in 2000, forecloses the first claim, and the fact that 3583K was enacted by Congress against the backdrop of that case further forecloses the second of the two requirements that Shakespeare will have to satisfy in this case. Unless your honors have any further questions, for those reasons, we think that Shakespeare does not come close to showing plain error in this case.
Well, what about the comment by Mr. Jackson that this court's opinion in Haman 1 said that prosecution, in addition to revocation statute, would be a violation of the double jeopardy clause? How do you respond to that?
I think the response to that our response is, first of all, Haman 1 was vacated by the Supreme Court on review in Haman.
Part of it can be vacated and the rest remains authority within the circuit, at least.
Right, but especially in the case like Haman, where the contested issue was precisely what is the nature of this 3583K proceeding and what is the basis to rule the constitutional or unconstitutional. The comments, which, by the way, as Your Honor, and that was going to be my second point, the word dictum in Haman 1 would go with the rest of the holding. And the Supreme Court, in a splinter decision, obviously endorsed different rationales, that there's a plurality and a concurrence. And so against that backdrop, the idea that Haman 1 sort of remains presidential for a point like double jeopardy that was not actually presented in Haman 1 or 2, that only addressed jury trial, we submit would be several steps too far. And that gets me to the second point, which is, as Your Honor also pointed out before, any comment about double jeopardy in Haman 1 would have been dictum. And in any event, the language that this court used in discussing double jeopardy confirms that it was a most, if you will, gesturing to a potential issue. It was not making any sort of holding as double jeopardy. And again, certainly not any holding that would survive the Supreme Court's review of that issue in Haman and vacater of this court's decision in Haman 1. Unless, sir, I'm happy to answer any questions that Your Honors may have about these issues. Unless Your Honors have any further questions, we would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Counsel, I think you used all of your time, did you not, Mr. Jackson?
I did. I used my time and then some. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah. I think we're kind of out of questions right now. So thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Counsel excused.